I'm Laura Johnson. I'm one of the London CDA network, which organised this event tonight. Firstly, I'd like to welcome you all and thank you all for coming to what I'm sure will be a very interesting and stimulating debate. For those of you who are not aware, this public debate tonight forms part of a wider two-day conference, which is aimed to discuss the research and experience of students, academics, and institutions involved in the HSE's Collaborative Doctoral Award. The aim of tonight's discussion was to move the debate away from just a discussion of the merits of the CDA's particular award, and to discuss the role and impact of collaborative and interdisciplinary research more generally. It remains for me to thank everyone who has made this conference tonight possible, and this conference and the event tonight possible. Firstly, all the conference organisers who really have worked tirelessly to bring about this event, particularly Catherine Pearin, who has really spearheaded this event right from the beginning, and many others who I'm not going to stop mentioning because I'll forget someone and cause lots of problems. Secondly, of course, I'd like to thank all our speakers for coming along tonight to share their views and expertise. And lastly, and perhaps most importantly, I'd like to thank all our sponsors for their generous funding and support, particularly the Arts and Humanities Research Council, the Institute for Historical Research, the School of Advanced Study, University of London, and of course Tate for providing this venue tonight. I'd now like to hand you over to the head of research here at Tate, who has kindly agreed to introduce and chair tonight's discussion, Professor Nigel Cowellan.
Thanks, Laura, very much. And on behalf of Tate, a warm welcome. You've had a long day, but I hope that this session, which is as informal as we can make it, will be a good way to end. And there's always the lure of a drink afterwards. The schedule is that we've got about an hour and a half, absolute maximum, in this room. And we've all agreed with the speakers and the organisers that if people feel they've exhausted the topic a little before that, then we will just end things and move next door and keep talking, but more socially, over a glass of something. Collaborative research, new knowledge, new challenges. What we're going to try and do this evening is to use some interventions to launch a debate. And the event will have worked well if at some point during the course of the next hour and a half, some of you have got some questions and some issues which you want to raise and engage either with each other or with the four colleagues who've been good enough to come and sit up in front of you and say a few things to get it started. In preparing for the event, I alerted the speakers, the presenters, the four of them, to the main issues that the conference organisers had pointed up to me. And I'll just share those with you because that might just frame the context of for the next few minutes. First of all, some thoughts that they might have on the nature of interdisciplinary research. What is it? Has it changed through time? Is it what it always was? And is it actually all it's cracked up to be? Does a scheme such as the Collaborative Doctoral Award Scheme, which is inter-institutional, necessarily imply an interdisciplinary intellectual engagement? I guess the answer is probably not, but it might do. There's a bit of an issue there for people to chew around. Is or should collaboration always something that should be interdisciplinary? Is it about the subject matter or is it about the people who are doing it? So those are the things which I've asked them to have in mind. And I'll now just give you a sense of how it's all going to work. I'll ask them each to present to you for no more than 5 minutes, just one after the other. I'll ask Shira West, who's an art historian, currently working for the AHRC as the Director of Research, And I'll ask her to start off, and she's told me that her theme is post-disciplinarity. Very intriguing. She'll be followed by Lizzie Jackson, sitting just to Shira's right, who's going to talk about the twin themes of translation and trust working across disciplines. And she comes from a rather different standpoint, which is particularly useful, and warm welcome to Lizzie Jackson. She's going to be drawing on her experience working with a BBC AHRC collaborative scheme. So as she put it to me, she's going to be offering some thoughts from a rather different kind of coalface from the usual academic one. Third's going to come Chris Bruard, sitting nearer to me at this end, from the research department at the V&A, who's going to talk about the museum perspective on collaborative projects and collaborative doctoral work, focusing on the challenges of reconciling those two very distinct contexts and expectations. And finally, Sarah Arbour at the far end, coming not from the disciplinary area that's at the centre of the AHRC field of knowledge, but from the Centre for Research on Ageing and Gender at the University of Surrey. And so her perspective is going to be from the social sciences. She's been involved in several joint schemes funded by the ESRC and the Medical Research Council as well, supporting doctoral supervisions. And fascinatingly, her area of interest has been much to do with sleep. Some of you, I think, no, I won't say that. mainly in the area of sleep with physiologists at Surrey, and she's also been a principal investigator on a large multidisciplinary collaborative research project on sleep and aging. My experience is that the older you get, the less you sleep, but maybe that's something. It's true. Yeah, it's fantastic. Yeah. Well, I'm glad I'm... We can talk about it. Right, we will. I'll be asleep probably by then. And she's going to briefly present about her experiences of the challenges of inter- and multidisciplinary work with larger projects. So, 5 minutes each. At the end of that, I will ask them just to have an exchange with each other, just picking up anything that they are curious about from what their colleagues have said, and then we will effortlessly move into the theatre mode, using you to intervene and contribute. I should say that it's standard practice on these events at Tate for the event to be taped. So an audio recording is being made. I'll just check that with the speakers. If any of you are unhappy about that, that's tough. Okay. But do be aware, those of you who are going to be contributing from the floor, as I hope you will, that it will be taped. For which reason, in order to make it possible for everyone to hear, there are going to be some handheld microphones. So when we start to move into that part of the session, we'll get these microphones deployed and get people carrying. Now, have we got volunteers for the microphone duties? We've got. Okay, very good. So, Shira, all yours.
Thank you very much, Nigel. It's a great pleasure to be here and to be able to talk to you tonight. I'm going to use my 5 minutes to talk about a couple of things that I think are in the research zeitgeist that are sort of related to the Collaborative Doctoral Awards. And the first of these, I think, is what I would say is that the lone scholar is rapidly becoming an outdated concept. And the second point I would make is that we're entering an era of post-disciplinarity, which I'm going to explain in a minute. The other day, I was reading the essays of David Hume, as one does, and I discovered that in 1742, Hume actually made a very good argument for knowledge exchange, which I'm now going to read to you. He wrote, "The elegant part of mankind, who are not immersed in mere animal life, but employ themselves in the operations of the mind, may be divided into the learned and conversable. The separation of the learned from the conversable world seems to have been the great defect of the last age, and must have been a very bad influence both on books and company. For what possibility is there of finding topics of conversation fit for the entertainment of rational creatures without having recourse sometimes to history, poetry, politics, and the more obvious principles, at least, of philosophy? On the other hand, learning has been as great a loser by being shut up in colleges and cells and secluded from the world and good company. Even philosophy went to wreck by this moping recluse method of study and became as chimerical in her conclusions as she was unintelligible in her style and manner of delivery. And indeed, what could be expected from men who never consulted experience in any of their reasonings or who never searched for that experience where alone it is to be found in common life and in conversation? Now, I think Hume has a really brilliant argument there for knowledge exchange, and I think we're in a world where our academics are combining Hume's learned and conversable world. I still think, as academics, we have to retreat into our towers occasionally to read Proust and write great papers, but equally, it is now expected of an academic in a 21st century global culture that in your academic career, in your research career, you will also be collaborating as well as working by yourself. I think that's one point I'd like to make, and I think we could probably have a lot of discussion about that later. And the second point I want to make is this idea of post-disciplinarity, and I want to tell you what I mean by that. By that, I'm not talking about interdisciplinarity necessarily, and I'm not talking about anti-disciplinarity. I'm not denying the value of individual disciplines, and I'm not denying the value of interdisciplinary work. But in a post-disciplinary world, those intellectual qualities that are developed by people in their various disciplines or working in an interdisciplinary way are what is required. What happens once you've had your degree and your PhD and you've written your book and you're a trained intellectual in a particular field is you then become institutionalized in a departmental silo and essentialize yourself as a historian or an art historian or whatever. And I'm suggesting that research in a post-disciplinary world is driven by questions, by issues, by processes that may well come from a single discipline, but may come from other interdisciplinary work as well. And just to finish off, and to take that point to a very recent study by NESTA, which is the National Endowment of Science and Technology and the Arts, NESTA have come up with a recent idea that we are now in the age of what they call fifth generation innovation. Now, I'm not going to tell you what all five generations are, but I will tell you what the first one is and the fifth one is. The first generation of innovation, which is very passé now, is a scientist, and it would have been a scientist, working in their laboratory, coming up with a great idea, an industry taking that idea and turning it into a widget, and then the widget being sort of becoming a consumer good in the marketplace somehow. So it's a completely linear model from research to consumer goods. In fifth generation innovation, which is where we are now, that's about co-production, which involves all areas of knowledge, science, social science, arts and humanities, and users, which in our community can be museums, galleries, archives, schools, religious organizations, government departments, creative industries, could be any number of things. All of those collective, all of those people working together collectively towards a common end. And I think the thing about post-disciplinarity in this fifth generation of innovation, it's risky, it's difficult, it's prone to failure, you're more likely to fail when you do it this way, but it's also creative, it's exciting, and if it succeeds, it can be transformative. And I think what excites me about the Collaborative Doctoral Award holders and the whole idea of this fifth generation innovation is that you are that generation, and I will be very interested to see in 20 years' time how that has transformed the research landscape. So, thank you.
Very good. Thank you very much. Lizzie.
Right. I'm going to move, if that's all right.
The mics are on. Just gives you somewhere else to look. Well, my comments follow on really well from that. I'm going to talk about a collaborative research project, which was co-funded by the AHRC and the BBC, and it's been running from 2007 to 2009. What some of the things that we found out, that's the people actually doing the research, which was BBC Children's working with the research team from the University of Westminster. Some of the things we found out about working together collaboratively. The project was to find out how children inhabit and engage with virtual worlds, mainly through the case study of Adventure Rock, the BBC's first 3D virtual world for children, which was very exciting. And we asked 90 children from across the UK what they thought about the virtual world before it launched in April 2008. So this was during the beta tests before it launched. Two things came out, trust and translation. Trust. The BBC Children's producers had to trust that we would not, that's the research team whom I'm representing, that we would not say anything terrible about their new service. And we had to trust, as the research team, that the BBC would allow us to be critical in order to reflect the evidence we'd collected. The solution was we agreed to give the BBC indicative findings which would alert them to any major problems in the new virtual world during the restricted test, which was with also 1,000 other children. And then they could make changes, which they did. BBC Children's worked with us to organise the first conference for producers and academics interested in virtual worlds for children, at which the findings of the study were released. BBC Children's had not seen our full findings before the day. We'd just given them indicative findings and talked them carefully through with them. But they trusted us that we would A, reflect the facts, and B, that we would report that our research partners, BBC Children's, were adjusting the service, as indeed they were. So the solution was to release any sensitive findings to the partners first and allow time for them to make adjustments. And these findings could then be included in the substantiated findings, framed as being in the distant past but still fact. We trusted BBC Children's to work with us to organise a conference, a big conference. 300 people came from across the UK, Europe and from the States. BBC Children's trusted us to provide a good venue. We chose the speakers together. It was a big success, and mainly because everybody there, which was 50% academics and 50% producers working with children's media, were all interested in children's media. And we couldn't stop them talking, and everybody went to the pub after the conference to continue chatting. So the benefit to the development of children's media on that day was very high because we'd got together. BBC Children's trusted us to blog about the work in progress for 2 weeks at the Virtual Worlds Economic Forum in London, one of the first very big conferences in virtual worlds, on virtual worlds. However, we discussed the parameters of the blog entries together in advance. So this notion of very fast publishing was discussed and how to manage that. We trusted BBC Children's to provide us with a version of Adventure Rock to research in time for our workshops with the children, which they did with 1 week to go, but it was touch and go. But it did take trust on both sides. We trusted BBC Children's to find us somebody to work with, which they did, and they're finding me a designer to work with in March as well. So that's trust. Now going on to translation. We wrote a document for BBC Children's, or I wrote a document for BBC Children's and BBC Future Media and Technology, who co-funded with the AHRC, to give the research findings in a written format which was common to industry. And so it was rather than an academic-style report. So we had to write our findings and construct the findings, how they came out, in a language which was neutral to both partners. So it didn't use jargon at all. So we wanted to publish and disseminate our findings fairly quickly, including anything which could have been seen as negative. The BBC felt they wanted to delay placing any controversial findings into the public domain until Adventure Rock the World had matured as a service. We therefore agreed not to publish findings until 2 years had passed since the fieldwork had been completed, but that's almost up. I mean, we've got a year to go, and I've started writing the articles, and the articles will take a year to publish anyway. So the timings have worked for us as research partners. So the timings of the release of findings need to be both practical and useful to both parties. I trust the BBC Children's Project Manager to manage the element of the funding they manage, and they trust me to manage mine. And we compare notes. As research partners, we communicate with each other regularly, mainly via email. We've developed ways of working together. This has reduced the amount of contacts. Now we've got used to working together at meetings by 75% as the studies progress. We both use virtual working so we can send documents backwards and forwards and communicate. And happily until we feel we need to meet face to face. Next week, a producer from BBC Children's and I will be working with 60 producers and academics to imagine and invent public service virtual worlds for adults. We'll both be representing our organisations and showing what we feel is our work together. And we'll be extending the knowledge towards the rest of the BBC, but not only to the rest of the BBC. I suggested we open out the workshops to producers who are interested in public service media who might not work for the BBC. After talking about this together with the BBC and AHRC collaborative funders, everybody agreed this would be a great idea. Public service virtual environments will therefore be discussed next week by a more diverse group of people, all of whom have something in common, an interest in either virtual life or public service media. Plus, at the end of the day, there will be a network of people created from which we can all draw in the future. So, to conclude, the 21st century is about networking. Networks operate through the viral transmission of ideas, widening the media network to include media creators and media thinkers amplifies the level of knowledge in the system, giving speed and direction, which is beneficial to all.
Thank you. Thanks very much. When you're ready. Okay. Well, I start with a confession, a disciplinary confession. I'm a fashion historian. It's rather like a 12-step program that I start and define who I am here. And I've always had, because of that, I've always had a problem with the whole concept of disciplines, and I've always felt, actually, on a personal note, that the best place to sit is in the margins or in the interstices, that they are the most productive places from which new ideas develop. And if you're looking at an object of study that perhaps is on the periphery of disciplinary viewpoints, then it's very necessary to celebrate that marginal or interstitial kind of position. And I think, again, on a personal note, just reflecting on Nigel's call to think about interdisciplinarity and whether notions of interdisciplinarity have changed over time, I can only reflect personally here as a fashion historian, then certainly I've always felt that I've been sitting outside or battling with particular disciplinary positions, the old costume historians and their object focus, the rise of cultural studies and its particular take on fashion as object and process, but also between institutions. I was an academic in a former life and always chose to push my studies through the art school sector. So although trained as an art historian, I found that position between theory and practice that was generated by art school thinking, again, to be the most productive place to sit, but it came with its own set of challenges. But now I find, because I guess of the development of interdisciplinary thinking and the development of collaborative funding that allows for particular sorts of projects to take place, that I'm in a museum where the notion of the collaborative is all important and the notion of the disciplinary is very much less so. And I've had very direct experience of that, which takes me away, and I think takes the field away, from perhaps a rather depressing notion 10 years ago, when those of you who come from the art historical or the museological field will be aware, a publication came out called The Two Art Histories from the Clark Institute Conference of 1999, which argued that we had in the one corner museum curators who deal with cataloguing or else are so kind of taken up with notions of the brand and the commercial that they have no interest in questioning or taking forward particular sorts of disciplinary debates. And in the other corner, we have the art historians who have gone down a kind of theoretical dead end that has no relevance at all to museum visitors. And I felt that to be an entirely unuseful, and I now, looking back on those sorts of writings, an entirely unuseful way to position the sort of work that we all do wherever we are in our institutions. And I've had personal experience of that through benefiting from two publicly funded big projects that have resulted in exhibitions, in publications, in conferences, and that have brought together different research councils. And it completely changed my attitude towards the production of research and its usefulness in the broader sphere. The first was the Cultures and Consumption programme that was sponsored both by the AHRC and the ESRC. So in, you know, bringing together the social sciences, the humanities and the arts in an examination of the role of questions of consumption in contemporary and historical societies. And we had a number of projects in that team where I was working with geographers on the notion of the of 60s London and the concept of the swinging 60s and its relationship to the fashion industries of London and the world at the time. It produced an exhibition at the Museum of London and an exhibition at the V&A where I'd just moved, and as I say, a number of academic articles, broader conferences, television programmes, the whole gamut. And it was one of the best experiences, as I say, of my academic research career so far. And I'm right in the middle of a very similar project, the Diaspora's Migration and Identities Programme, where we're working on a particular collection in the V&A. Again, I remember with geographers, it's that spatial term. Maybe some disciplines do actually come to take over. We're all geographers now, perhaps. But I've really enjoyed that, working with different groups of geographers, working in different situations to look at the concept of fashion from my position. Shira was talking about that tension between the individual scholar in working in their own worlds and the notion of collaboration. I think we might broaden out that on looking back on my experience of those two collaborative projects to think of moments when discipline is important, when the lone scholar is very necessary, and those moments when collaboration and thinking across disciplines becomes incredibly positive and innovative. So there's a researching and thinking moment where it's very necessary to create dialogue between disciplines or even between institutions. There's that moment of quiet reflection and writing, which was what I enjoyed most looking back on my time as a PhD student, which is a gorgeously romantic and wonderful self-reflexive moment. And then there's that moment in the museum of display and of exhibitions where you actually come to meet your audience. And I'll come on to audiences and users in a moment. And that is truly collaborative in all senses of the world. It's not monographic. It's not about the individual article. Perhaps I benefit a lot because a lot of the work I do and the sort of museum I work in is very object-centred. It's about the thing. And thinking about things, which we do all the time within the humanities, allows us a sense of focus. And that sense of focus, looking around the object from different disciplines, supplies a sort of oil to debate, I think. And that's where collaboration can really work, in its the concentration from different perspectives on one thing, on one material, one concept. But then we have the arguments over approach, and that perhaps supplies a sort of grit. So I think this sort of combination of oil and grit, sorry, my metaphors are getting very kind of earthy, and is what sits at the centre of the sort of collaborative work that I do, and what constitutes the sort of positive aspects of interdisciplinarity for museum work. What perhaps holds that back, and where the challenges lie, are in the more practical issues that I'm sure all of you who are on the CDA programme are grappling with, of institutional expectations, of deadlines, and of the particular kind of strategic positions of the institutions that you're working in, that can actually cause real friction in terms of how you're dealing with your own individual output. And that's something perhaps we need to think about a little more, where those tensions arise, a different sort of grit. Finally, should this sort of cross-institutional collaboration between museums and universities necessarily mean interdisciplinary work? Do the two things mean the same thing? Well, I've touched on that there, that problem of institutional expectations, the conflict between the individual thesis and the broader project, perhaps. I think the other interesting way to come to this, I mentioned it earlier, is through the concept of audience, reader, user, visitor, however we like to constitute the word. And I think that's a very real challenge for CDA students. When I was a PhD student, I wasn't really sure who my thesis was for. I think it was for me to go and read a lot and feel very proud of myself, and then maybe one or two other academics might read it after me. The difference with museum-based work and display-based work is that it reaches huge audiences. So it requires a very broad view. And it's not necessarily the kind of view that's generated by the old-style loan scholarship, the old-style PhD project, which is a rather narrower journey. No less special and no less important, but a very different sort of journey. But I was very enlivened and engaged at the session of the conference I went to this morning, thinking in terms of a user of the sort of research that you're all producing, because I'm looking towards curating a big exhibition in 2012 about a very broad project. And I think if I'd gone to a PhD conference 5 years ago, I would have found it difficult to get an entry into the projects I was hearing about. The debates I was hearing this morning fed directly into the ideas I was having for an exhibition that has to have broad audience appeal, to ask the right sort of innovative, research-driven questions that will make my exhibition and my team's exhibition a positive experience for all. And I felt that I could immediately engage with those students who were at a reasonably early stage of their research and think, yes, you understand the way that your objects or the center of your study engage with this much broader audience and this much broader context. So I think the post-disciplinary, maybe the post-institutional, I'm not sure about that, is quite a nice place to be. It's as nice as the marginal or the interstitial. So those are my thoughts.
Chris, thanks very much. Sarah, just before we start, can I just say that some of the speakers have been fantastically good at their 5 minutes.
Not me.
Others have not been. So, Sarah, if you could try to be...
I'll try and be 5 minutes. Yeah, I'll do my best. Okay, as Nigel said at the introduction, I'm a sociologist, and I feel a bit of an imposter here, but I'm very pleased to be here anyway. There are kind of three areas of my work which might be of relevance to talk about. Firstly, at Surrey, as a sociology department, we've had what are called case awards, which are collaborative studentships in PhDs with ESRC funding, probably for about 15 years. So it's been going hugely longer than the equivalent AHRC program. And we've had, I don't know how many we've had, but probably about 15 case students. And they've been doing PhDs jointly with government departments like Office for National Statistics, Home Office, Cabinet Office, and so on, with the BBC, with Sage Publications, with computer companies like Sapient, with charities, and so on. So there have been huge numbers have done it, and they've all got through, and they've all actually had difficulties along the way sometimes, but all successfully completed within their 4 years. And I think the students have ended up with a really very broad experience, not only the academics experience, but the case award has given them that practical experience, policy experience, commercial experience, And I think they benefited enormously from that. Some have ended up getting jobs with the case partners, others going into research or academic posts, but they've been very successful. So I think it augurs very well for the equivalent programme for AHRC. Moving on a little bit to some of my own experience of PhD supervision, I've supervised quite a number of interdisciplinary PhD students. Some have been interdisciplinary with sociology, psychology. You might think they're similar disciplines, but actually they're still quite different disciplines. But more recently, I've done joint supervision with biologists, physiologists, chronobiologists, and so on, with ESRC, MRC, doctoral awards, and so on. And it's been quite interesting because we've started off thinking these are going to be truly joint, half and half sociology, half biology. But inevitably, they've ended up being more of one side or the other side. So even though we think they're going to start off exactly the same, the students somehow have graduated more one way or the other way. That doesn't mean they haven't had interdisciplinary elements within them. And I'll give a couple of examples. One of my current students has been looking at sleep and ageing and looking at why it is that older people tend to wake up earlier in the morning. So the scientists talk about larks and owls, you know, people who kind of like getting up early and those who go to, you know, like staying up late, and how that changes with ageing and how that relates to circadian factors and so on. And the qualitative work was interviewing older people about these things. And we thought it'd be equal, but she ended up getting more into some of the physiology, which was the way in which, in fact, she did some genotyping analysis in this as well, and the way in which light and for people who are evening people, morning people, to what extent they had different light exposures and that impacted on their sleep and so on. So although she's got a sociological part to it, it ended up being more scientific. Another one, which again started out joint, was looking at nurses who do shift work, women nurses who do shift work. And there's a vast amount of work on shift work, mainly done by biologists and kind of scientists. But she was interested in the impact of nurses' shift work on their partners, in this case the male partners, and on children, on their children. And again, she collected a whole range of kind of more scientific data using what we call ActiWatches and cortisol samples and various other things as well. But the in-depth interviews with the partners and with the children just gave her much richer data. So it's ended up more on the kind of the sociology side than the science side. But that doesn't mean she isn't within that discussing some of the more scientific data. So we've got things like the way in which shift work impacts on children, and the children talk about that, and the way in which they're actually stressed by their mother working, but they're actually more relaxed in many ways, and they go to bed later, they talk about that. But again, from the scientific data, we actually can measure that actually the children do go to bed later, so they actually get less sleep while their mothers are working, so because the fathers don't push them to bed and things like that. So there's been a substantiation with the scientific and the social and the more qualitative sociological data. Anyway, in terms of some of our multidisciplinary research, I've had a number of multidisciplinary projects with biologists, physiologists, psychologists, and current project is the one which Nigel introduced, which is funded by, in fact, 5 different research councils, ESRC, MRC, EPSRC, AHRC, and BBSRC, part of the New Dynamics of Aging program, and it's looking at how to optimise quality of sleep among older people, both living in the community and care homes. So I, as a sociologist, I'm the principal investigator of a very large project which involves 4 universities and 6 disciplines. So it involves psychology, physiology, medicine, nursing, and engineering, as well as sociology. So it's kind of a big thing. We also have 5 non-academic project partners, and they range quite widely from Philips Lighting, who are obviously a commercial partner. They're interested in developing blue-enriched light because, again, the theory from the science is that blue-enriched light improves sleep. And so we're doing some evaluations both in care homes and in the community of older people by giving them kind of trials of blue-enriched light. Other partners include voluntary organisations like Help the Aged and working with users and so on. So this is a very complex big 4-year project. It's interdisciplinary. It involves what are called 8 work packages. Some of those work packages are themselves interdisciplinary, others kind of feed into each other and, you know, more monodisciplinary within. And I could talk much more, if people would like me to, about aging and sleep. So one of the things I just kind of sum up, what do I think is the kind of the key things for interdisciplinary research? I think one of the key things is that it requires time. If you're working with biologists, physiologists, and you're a social scientist, you start beginning to talk to them, and you're talking past each other. They've got a different language than we've got. So they use all these terms, our first meetings, where they're talking about polysomnography and constant routine and this, that, and that. I kind of thought, what the hell are they talking about? And we were talking about all sociological things, and they thought, what the hell is she talking about? But now, having had a lot of communication over a number of years and meetings and heard them talk, they've heard me talk and so on, I can, you know, talk their language and understand what they're talking about. And I hear them talking about the social context of sleep and how that's important. And I realise that they've, by osmosis, taken on sociological ideas and concepts, and I've taken on the physiological ideas and concepts as well. And therefore, we can actually kind of work together in this way. So I think for any successful interdisciplinary research, it doesn't happen overnight. It takes time. And the importance of communication, dialogue, formal meetings, informal meetings, over drinks, dinner, and so on, is terribly important. And I think the fundamental basis is a mutual respect for each other's discipline and approach. So sociologists do different things in different ways than scientists who do things in labs and they try and control everything and all that. And, you know, it's different. They've got different parts and so on. And we need to kind of understand and respect those differences. So I personally, I think kind of fitting in with Chris, this marginal is great because you're working with two disciplines and you kind of, you know, you suddenly hear something they say and you think, God, you know, that questions my assumptions. And I say things and that questions their assumptions. So it's actually very challenging, I think, working at these interstices between disciplines. But it's also fun and also very exciting. So thank you.
Thanks very much to the four presenters there. I'm going to ask them in a minute to just respond to each other's contributions. We're just coming up to 7 o'clock, so I think we'll just have a few minutes of that before we throw it open to the floor. But I just want to start things perhaps by just picking up something that Shira said. We're more likely to fail, Shira, you said, if we are engaged in an interdisciplinary activity. And I made a note of that, and then several of the speakers came up with possible reasons. The time, which Sarah pointed to as being so important, possibly the lack of respect, the fact that if you're engaging with somebody else, it requires a human interpersonal dimension, which the lone scholar, you can be a monster sitting on your own in a room. In fact, we know them, and they're sitting. But you can't do that if you want to engage in the kind of teamwork practice. So, Shira, do you want to just think a bit about that? Why is it so hard?
Okay, well, I've had a lot of thoughts while people were talking, and I think when Chris was talking about the art object and different people taking the object and looking at it differently, I think that's a metaphor for the whole thing I'm talking about. You've got the problem, the question, is it sleep, is it an art object, and you've got people coming in it from different points of view. But I think that human side is important, but I also think it is partly language, which is what Sarah was saying, but I also think it's method. I think people have different methods of tackling what they do. And those barriers are stronger than the language ones sometimes, because you can learn somebody else's language, but you find their methods alien. So I think that's something to say about that. This is sort of slightly tangential, but one of our program directors, or in fact our Design of the 21st Century program director, told me a story about a jar lid that was invented by some engineer that could open more easily than normal jar lids for elderly people so that they could get their jars open without, you know, if they have arthritis or whatever. And this was great, and they took it out to a community and tested it, and people didn't like it because what they said was, well, if I can't open my jar, my daughter comes and visits me and opens the jar for me. And that was never thought about by by the engineer who invented the wonderful jar lid. And so I think there are methodology issues, there are issues of expectation. And I think the point you make about human interaction is absolutely right. And that and that goes back to what Lizzie was saying about trust, that if you haven't built up your relationship with your partners in some way before you actually plunge into the big questions, then you might come, you know, adrift because the trust hasn't been built up before. So that's my answer to your question.
Colleagues, have you got things you want to pick up from what each other have said? The floor's yours for a few minutes. Chris?
Yeah, just some small points that might generate further discussion or further questions. I think this question of language and respect are very key ones. Lizzie used the term in terms of the sort of documentation you were producing of producing some sort of neutral language that was beyond disciplinary jargon or positions. And I thought, yes, finding that sort of neutral but engaging voice that includes all elements of a cross-disciplinary or a cross-institutional project is incredibly important. It was picked up again and underlined by Sarah's point about mutual respect and respect for each other's disciplines, which is important when you're working with not just cross-disciplinary co-workers or co-project team, but it taps into all sorts of aspects of collaborative interdisciplinary research, generational and international global research. I think it's very important to hold on to that question of mutual respect for different positions and different traditions, and interdisciplinarity shouldn't rub those down in any ways. With Shira, it's a particular use of language about the user, which I think we might come back to, and whether museums, sorry, now I'm being disrespectful, but whether museums really are users of research or whether museums generate a different sort of research that might move the other way.
No,
I've always been sort of concerned about knowledge transfer. Yeah. I prefer knowledge exchange or
which
knowledge
I used
dialogue.
When I
you
talked
did?
About
good,
you.
Good, good.
I but, deliberately didn't use knowledge transfer.
But I think we might think about that. What constitutes the user? Mm. And is the user the audience,
question.
Actually, rather than the relationship between two institutions?
Sarah, I think you had a question.
I didn't, actually.
Didn't you? I thought you waved a finger.
No. I was just waving.
You're thinking of cricket.
No, I was waving. Sorry.
Does anybody out there...
I think Lizzie had a question.
I think what's happening when you're doing... Sarah's mentioned, sort of working with an academic organisation working with an industry partner. There's a lot of things that come out about, you know, when to keep the research private, when it can go public, and about the nature of goods, you know, cultural goods or facts that you find out, and confidentiality. And I think as there's more and more of a demand to go public faster with findings...
Yeah, that's right.
Then you need to sort of resist that as a researcher and say it's got to come out when it's ready, but also to be mindful of the fact that it is good to get out elements of your findings as fast as you can, but to do it with care.
I don't know whether anybody in the audience shares my skepticism about the cozy world which we've had described, the world where it's fun being on the margins and, you know, how enjoyable it is to being in the interstices, what fun it is engaging with other disciplines because they respect what you do. I worked for years in universities where many of my colleagues, I'm ashamed to say, held each other's subject fields in complete disrespect, contempt. would cheat behind their back, steal resources. You know, you turn your back and you find you've moved out of your room. It's not like that at the moment. I mean, maybe what we were hearing is some sort of description of how, in an ideal world, it should be, and the world that the AHRC can bring about. But the floor is now yours. If you could say sure. Who you are, that would be great.
Yeah, Chris Whitehead from Chris Whitehead from Newcastle University. I just wanted to pick up on two points that Shira made. One about the jar story, and this is a slightly flippant point, but I suspect if they'd tested it on elderly people's daughters, they might have got a much more positive response. So there's a slightly serious point in there, which is about the right users of research. The other is to do with the notion of post-disciplinary situations and getting out of disciplinary silos, which is something that's sort of very interesting and I would really welcome. But I was wondering how that squares with the fact that there are however many research councils and whether they constitute silos and whether, you know, sometimes it's actually quite difficult for us as applicants figuring out if it's okay to use social sciences methodologies in an AHRC application. And so there's that kind of issue. And on top of that, there's the dreaded RAE or REF, which has its own structures and imposes its own silo mechanisms on those of us who actually work in universities. You know, I know in advance that I will probably be submitted to the art history panel. How does that make me think about any kind of collaborative work that I might be doing? In fact, I'm applying to New Dynamics of Aging. I have no idea how that will square with the REF, which takes the place of the RAE next time around. So there are these sorts of issues of overlap and silos and a kind of, I guess, idealistic post-disciplinary position. But how does it actually work in practice?
Can I respond to that, Chris? I mean, I've got... The institutional issues are interesting, because if you look at what universities have been doing the last 2 or 3 years, they've been merging departments into these bigger blobby units, into schools and into colleges and whatever. And they're also beginning to look towards institutional themes to try to get people to work across disciplinary boundaries. I think it's going to be a long time before those departmental silos break down, but you can actually see that in institutional organizations at the moment. The research councils, well, the research councils are harmonizing in all sorts of ways, and we're moving towards becoming one big happy family, but we are not there yet, and we're a long way from being there. So you're right to point out that is an issue. But the cross-council themes we work with are exactly designed to try to bring together different areas. I mean, there are things that don't work, as far as I'm concerned, about those, but I won't talk about that now because I'm being taped. So I can't do Chatham House rules, which is what I usually want to do. Anyway, but the methodology thing, the AHRC is very open about methodology. Some of the other councils are not, and that's an interesting division between... In fact, we have an intellectual property centre in Edinburgh, and we asked the head of that centre, why didn't you apply to the ESRC? And he said, because the AHRC is much more open about methodology and we want to use a variety of methods. So, there you are. Anyway, the REF is going to, we know it's coming, is going to have impact assessment in it, which is going to be about research that speaks beyond the academic community. And that's definitely coming into the REF, and I think that's going to change academic behavior quicker than anything else, particularly in arts and humanities, where 85% of our funding comes from that. And for those of you who don't know what the REF is, it's the Research Excellence Framework. I was at the Courtauld Institute the other day, and none of them knew what the REF was, rather interestingly.
They're excellent, anyway. So. They don't need any framework. Does anybody else from the panel want to respond?
Just very briefly.
And I think I disagree with you about kind of universities trying to merge everything in. I mean, our university went to schools and tried to make our disciplines separate, and we held out sociology, psychology, and economics to retain our departments. And this was about 8-10 years ago. New vice chancellor came in, got rid of schools and put them back into faculties and put back departments again. Unfortunately, because we kept into our department, it was other people actually found it much more difficult. So, and actually, departments can be very important. You know, for strong departments, you do have a discipline, and I think you do better interdisciplinary research if you have a strong disciplinary basis. So, you know, rather than a kind of mismatch of everything. So I think, you know, you have a home and you have an identity and you have that. And I do work on aging, I do work on health, I do work on sleep, and I'm a sociologist. If I was put into just a department of aging or something, I could only do work on aging. I wouldn't want that. You actually, I mean, we move around. Your aging might be the flavour of the month now, but in 5 years' time, maybe something else is. So I think, you know, you're better actually to have that strength of your discipline and then, you know, work in other areas as well. I think another aspect we haven't talked about, and I think maybe that came from the previous comment, was that we've got to disseminate our work, and that obviously relates to the REF and the RAE, and we do it in journals, peer-reviewed journals. And it just so happens that nearly all peer-reviewed journals are actually very strongly disciplinary-based. And even if they're called the Sleep or the Journal of Sleep Research, I've sent about, well, four articles with a more sociological point of view to these wonderful journals, all rejected, because they don't actually like a more sociological approach. I send the same thing to social science and medicine, and they take them. My PhD student, who I mentioned, who has done a more kind of science-based work on sleep, looking at light and sleep, submitted something, and I don't think it's at all a good article, recently been accepted, but because it fits into their experimental structure and so on and so forth. So that journals aren't disciplinary, but they have a particular way of doing things, particularly method, and they themselves actually don't necessarily want to be challenged, even though it's on the same topic of sleep, with a more sociological rather than a kind of traditional, kind of lab-based, sort of scientific, experimental sort of approach to it. So I think we might be trying to be interdisciplinary, but actually, you know, we're publishing in areas which often aren't necessarily conducive with editors and port teams to that interdisciplinary work.
Thanks, Sarah. Any more questions from the floor? Coming back to the panelists about their statements. There's somebody there. Thanks very much.
Hello, I'm Alex Hodby. I'm a CDA between Tate Modern and Goldsmiths. I wondered, bearing in mind what you've been discussing, and also because a lot of people here are researchers as well, do you think with that collaborative framework there's a need to find different ways of assessing the work that we'll produce or evaluating it? And I wondered what your thoughts were on that.
Are you talking specifically about the sort of postgraduate research you're doing?
Yes.
And kind of
acknowledging
the thesis idea.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And is the thesis... Well, enough, in a sense.
There's been a lot of move in recent years in some areas to loosen up the framework of the thesis so that it doesn't just have to be the 80,000-word text. There's a lot more practice-based, you know, and some people in film studies do visual material as part of it. So there's a sort of mix of practice and text. But I think you're right. I think the whole output issue hasn't really kept up with changes in what people are doing, and maybe there is something to be looked at there. I know some universities are looking at this and have looked at it and have made changes, but then you have the slight anxiety, how are you going to get an external examiner who really knows how to assess that? And so you might be putting your students at risk by doing that. So I think that there is a bit of a risk aversion there for very good reason, I think, but it's a good question.
Can I just say to AHRC, might it be possible to work into the criteria for the award of a CDA to a particular HEI, to a particular university, that the university should be able to show that its criteria for the award of the higher degree can accommodate safely the rather different circumstance within which the student is working? I mean, you ask them lots of pressing questions about... Sorry, the
HRC. Yeah,
we're just
a little wary about dictating university policy. Rob probably has an answer to that question. Mm. Sorry, Rob, you're not up here.
But... We always say it's not our job to tell...
Rob, just wait for the mic.
This is Rob Keegan, who's the CDA expert at the HRC.
We've always taken the view that it's not our role at the HRC to tell an institution how it should constitute... a PhD or a thesis. So I think, as Shira says, we're on quite sort of difficult ground there. As you say, we do ask very pressing questions. We do make sure that everything is in place for these awards to work properly. But it's certainly something we could look at, but I think we'd have to be very careful before we went down that route of telling HEIs how they should be examining their PhDs.
Yes, it wasn't quite what I had in mind. Thanks, Rob. Other questions? One here, and then another one in front. Sir, thank you.
Thank you. My name's Martin Linder. I'm a professor of industrial design at San Francisco State University. And thank you for allowing me to ask a question. The evidence is very clear that interdisciplinary activities lead to innovations that change history within domains. Okay, so I assume we all agree with this. Within this, it seems to me that to encourage interdisciplinary type behavior, we really are looking at how do we, I guess, change human behavior to some degree. What we're talking so far is dealing with it within kind of the university level as well as a professional level. My question is, what is happening in what we call the K through 12, the elementary schools, the middle schools, the high schools, to promote, to encourage, to teach our young to see the value of interdisciplinary activity and teach them methods and behaviors to encourage it so that when they do become a researcher at a university level or out in industry, they have better tools to be able to do this with and truly see the value to potentially really enhance their opportunity to be successful as interdisciplinary collaborative thinkers and researchers and potentially workers in industry. Thanks for allowing me to do that.
As an American.
No.
All right, okay.
You can answer as okay. yourself.
I can't answer as an American. There is a lot of, I think this is a tricky issue because there is a lot of stuff going on in the national curriculum at the moment to try to get people thinking in an interdisciplinary way. And there's the proposal for diplomas, you know, 16 to 18 year old diplomas and things. And I think in a way you risk throwing the baby out with the bathwater if you start too early on this. I think I agree with Sara. I mean, I wasn't quite making the point that you were disagreeing with me about earlier on about departments of aging or whatever. I really wasn't making that point. But I think that you have to build up a certain amount of expertise before you can be really good at pitching in at an interdisciplinary level. And I think some of the stuff that's going on in schools, and I have a daughter doing GCSEs at the moment, and fortunately she's not going through too much of this, but I can see the way there's an attempt to make kids think in an interdisciplinary way, which is good, but in the meantime, they haven't got sufficient background and experience in any discipline to be able to do it very effectively. So, I mean, that's personal view, but obviously there's a different personal view coming up here. So.
Can I take my comment?
Yeah.
Just wait for the mic, and then after you've made the comment, there's a question down in front. But if you'd allow this person just to comment back on that.
Just to comment back on that, I would have to disagree with that. I would say that what this gentleman is saying is very important because I would say that the nub of what we're talking about is tied to cognition and tied to really encouraging autonomy in children and, you know, through the educational process. So... divergent thinking and being able to encouraging associations, multiple associations, transcending conformity is what interdisciplinary and multidisciplinary research is all about. That in itself is an expertise that develops exceptional cognition, and it is exceptional cognition and high autonomy. These things tend to work simultaneously that create a type of thinking that becomes integrated into the person's psyche, and therefore they don't need trends or fashions or somebody external to constantly sort of put them on cue as to how or when they should be thinking across a certain field. In fact, it's, you know, this type of thinking that does produce innovation in the, if you like, the lone individual genius or whatever, because that process in the lone individual is exactly, the cognitive process is exactly the same as what many are trying to achieve. I would say that the interest in interdisciplinary research is ultimately trying to achieve the same type of cognition that exists in exceptional human, you know, lone human beings, which I believe is a potential that does reside in everyone. So I think that's what needs to be encouraged. I think we see society, our society here, and also globally, more and more people are encouraged towards conformity, ever-increasing narrowing of consciousness, and this paradoxically is resulting in the world traumas that we are witnessing today, from health problems, war, the destruction of the environment. So paradoxically, I think, although we are encouraging something that's very good, it seems a terrible shame that human beings, due to their narrowness and autonomy, I think it's important that autonomy is understood to be the opposite of individualism. Individualism is really a lack of autonomy, a narrowing of consciousness, not thinking in the broader scheme of things, that is creating the destruction not only of the health, but of the of people, but the environment. And still, as we know, 2/3 of the world population are living on less than $2 a day.
Right. Thanks very much.
Due to these processes not being activated, everyone exists in relation to another. Mm. And that's the process, the cognitive process of interdisciplinary research. Mm.
So in America, we would say, right on.
Right. Well, now steady up. There'll be plenty of time for that. Others may want to comment on that principle that was touched on there, is the extent to which an individual can be interdisciplinary, as it were, on their own. There was somebody... The woman.
Hello.
Here.
Sally Taylor. I'm the director of the London Centre for Arts and Cultural Exchange. I'm not going to follow on from that except for the $2 a day bit. I wanted to raise the spectre of public value and draw that together with audiences and dissemination, because I do think one of the wonderful things about collaborative doctoral awards is precisely that, that it is about audiences, it is about dissemination, and it isn't, in my humble opinion, enough simply to think that dissemination in terms of putting things into academic journals will do at a time when public value is quite rightly rising up the agenda. And I just wondered, from the point of view of the ESRC and the AHRC, what their views were on this. Lizzie, it seems to me, has amply demonstrated how collaborative working can have extraordinary effects when managed well, when the research element is trusted very deeply within the culture of the organisation that you're working with. And I would like to see more of that and more made of it.
Can I just say, before people respond, we haven't asked AHRC and ESRC to come here to support their general policies, and I just feel slightly uncomfortable about the putting of the spot, which has just gone on. If people do want to come back, Sara, you're certainly not here because you represent the ESRC.
See, on ESRC committees, I'm on the research grants boards of ESRC,
yeah, but
so
that's
I do
not
have
why
quite
we
a,
asked
you
to
know,
come.
That's fine.
All right.
But I do. I mean, I think to answer that, people who are funded by ESRC, particularly with research grants, they have multiple requirements and goals. Clearly, they have to do academic publications, but there's a very strong emphasis on users, beneficiaries, impact, all those sorts of things. So if you put communication plans, etc. So anybody putting in a grant application has to put in kind of, you know, policy impact statements. How are they going to communicate their results of their research and engage with a whole range of different users? So on the current research which we're doing on aging and sleep, we're doing things like we're producing a module on older people's sleep, which is going on a thing called the DIPEX website, which is about patients' experiences of health and illness. So on this, we've got a lot of kind of, we're doing interviews with older people about how they sleep and how they cope with sleep, the strategies they use to improve their sleep and so on and so forth. So we're producing this whole module, which will give lots of information about how, not, there's no one right way of how to improve your sleep, but by actually showing the different ways that different people in different circumstances, how they cope with problem sleeping, that actually helps other people. But in addition, we are obviously producing, doing various workshops for care home managers, for different sorts of user groups, for voluntary organisations and so on and so forth, you know, producing things for practitioner journals, etc., etc. So, I mean, there's a huge range of different outputs and, you know, websites are crucially important as well, and you can do really kind of good interactive things on websites and so on and so forth. So I think anybody has to recognise that anybody with Research Council funding is not only going to be doing academic publications. They're important, but actually they are only one amongst a whole range of different ways in which user engagement or user involvement and communication of research findings is going on.
We're also we're going to have a new impact and beneficiary section on all of our forms. We're a newer council and we're coming to it a bit later, but that's from next month. We will be expecting people to, you know, be able to demonstrate this on major applications. Can I turn this around a little bit, though, about users? Because I think Chris raised an interesting point earlier on that got sort of lost a little bit. Normally when I use the word users, I put scare quotes around it because I think it sounds like drug addicts or something. And I think I actually agree that there are so many people involved in this, and there is a co-production model as well, where, you know, you think your public engagement dissemination is one aspect of what we do, but also when we're working with partners, we are actually co-producing the work, and so I find I usually do that to the user word, and I just wanted to bring that in because I thought that got a bit lost earlier on. So
yeah, my name is Dan Law. I'm currently a lone individual and formerly with Research Centre for Cognitive Neuroscience at the University of Auckland, and initially background in philosophy of language, epistemology and so on. Now, just a couple of things that I've found, and to respond to comments here, in trying to engage in cross-disciplinary research with art history departments and so on, I have found a real problem with differences in methodology, and that makes it really difficult to communicate. It's like, well, you could do it this way, but this is the way we do it. We'd expect to see that, and suddenly you're rebuffed, and it almost doesn't go further. And then in looking at evidence and trying to show it, you're dealing with interpretation through a particular lens, which means seeing it in a particular way, so once that building the communication across becomes very difficult. The other issue is one you picked up on about supervision. And one of the problems is if one's got something in the middle, in falling between the cracks, I've found there's not the competency to supervise research. We simply don't have the expertise to do that. We haven't got the ability to supervise. I've been working with a professor at the university on the side, and he's saying, I'm teaching him, so, you know, is trying to get him up to speed. Now, when you're then trying to work with art history department, it's like, well, this is actually becoming too hard, so you retreat back into the safe, normal, standard disciplines. And the other thing, just to comment, is on funding. That one looks at funding opportunities, and this doesn't fit in. It's geared towards this or that, so how do you tailor a funding application for something innovative and new and groundbreaking, which hasn't been actually perceived, when there isn't the funding call for that? And that then kicks back into the whole system of what's flavour of the month, what's going to get funding, what's... Yep. So you're not back again. Yep. So there's some thought.
Any response from the room to that? Does that chime with the experience that others have had?
Somebody in the middle of the room wants to come back, Catherine.
I don't want to knock the scheme because it's given me a fantastic opportunity. I'm at University of Plymouth and with Arts Matrix. The first point is I asked very early on why there are very few people collaborating on collaborative doctoral, as in two people doing PhD together. There's actually two people who've done one at Plymouth, and I think that's the only two people, or there might be a few more. But what that I think that says something in itself. That just, to me, seemed really wrong, that there's so many people who think interdisciplinary, struggle with working in these silos, and there's so few people doing it together. So that's the first point. And the second one is, I felt really thwarted by what is a very pushing forward, great university. You know, lots of things go on. I'm trying to attend something like 10 different research groups because they all fit with what I'm doing, and they all clash, and I can't get to them. And yeah, I've managed to find my way through that. And I think it's just a real, I'm trying to be very honest here, and it's a real struggle. You know, you can't go to the land water research group and the visual arts and media one and the performance group and the cultural geography group and the social science group, and they're all part of what I'm doing. And in terms of external examiners, I'm having a real problem trying to find one that might find a way through that. So trying to be honest there and not trying to be negative, just trying to...
No, we really value that. I mean, I think people have been saying all evening, this is not easy. And you've, from your personal standpoint, have pointed out ways in which it's not easy. We might ask colleagues to respond to that proposition that two or more doctorates might be awarded together so that the holders of those awards have not only got the interdisciplinary mix, perhaps in supervision, but also they've got the support amongst themselves in the team. Certainly that's something very familiar in the science world and maybe in the ESRC. Now, lots of people want to come through. We've got about another 10 minutes at the most, so keep your questions short. Thanks.
Hi, thanks. Yeah, just to sort of respond to that, and I guess really the other side of that is again another potentially very exciting possibility, which is the prospect for several organisations to perhaps also be working together on one particular sort of research strand, so that instead of there being one host organisation, you would have a potential scenario where you would have perhaps sort of four or five. I think particularly this would be very, very beneficial to those smaller organisations, perhaps in the arts and cultural industries, for example, that probably find having the capacity and resources to deal on a one-to-one basis with the kind of research that they'd like to, a dilemma. So perhaps sort of spreading the load that way could be, you know, very useful for them too.
Okay, thanks. And another question just to your right there.
Hello, my name is Prona Farah, and I'm a former director of interdisciplinary arts at the Arts Council in England. At the point where we set up that department, it was containable. You know, the notion of transdisciplinary and interdisciplinary between, say, 2004 and 2007, could be in its own space where you could sort of be the leading edge of things to follow. But I think what we've seen in the last 2 years is an amazing kind of cumulative approach where, you know, the word transdisciplinary interdisciplinary is kind of everywhere, which poses its own challenges because there's no way you can actually contain that. You will have 12 different research groups in one university all talking about this. So it's about combination and recombination. So what I'm doing now is I'm working on a joint MA-MSc, which is run between the Royal College of Art and Imperial College. Again, that's quite focused. It's around something called industrial design engineering. So it has at its heart, 20 years of development. What I think is still missing in and amongst all of this is any knowledge repository, a kind of cumulative build-up of where there have been insights into things that have been important happening at the intersection between disciplines. So everything you go to, people reinvent the wheel. They're always starting from the point of, this is a good thing, don't you realise it? And there seems to be nowhere where there's actually a centre of excellence where things are collected. So if I want to do a PhD in art and science together, where is that course? Where can I build on previous work, even though that kind of material has been around maybe since the 30s, a constructivist? And I think this is one really missing thing where the lady on my left was talking about, to actually recognise that it is a field in its own right, this kind of co-insection of things, which will be, of course, horizontal and meta, but at the same time, you can build up and accumulate research around those processes. And I think that would be something that I'd really recommend and like to see.
Thank you.
Can I just make a one-sentence comment? I promise, Nigel, one sentence. That I think we are in a process now, and I think, you know, we're somewhere on the spectrum, but we haven't quite got there yet. And some of the councils do support doctoral, I put some ands here, do support doctoral training centres. We've just given some money away to digital economy doctoral training centres, which are crossing over a whole range of disciplines. So,
thank you. Maybe one more question. If not, if it's come naturally to it, yes, towards the back. Sir.
Hi there. I'm Ben Cranfield. I'm a CDA student, London Consortium ICA, and a lecturer at Birkbeck College. This is sort of a question, but it's really responding to Nigel, your original note of realism about the situation, feeling like I've sort of been interjected into the world of collaboration, which has been wonderful but also problematic in two respects. Firstly, doing a CDA and being part of the first cohort to do that. And because of that CDA, pretty directly getting a job that involves setting up a foundation degree, which is very much sort of in the line of thinking about similar types of new knowledge production through an employer engagement. And so somehow becoming kind of like completely embedded in arguing in benefit of positive affirmation of those practices, and yet at the same time being quite sceptical about the way in which we're to understand the process that's going on, because I think that you can flip this completely on its head. Sometimes I think you can talk incredibly positively about the new aspects of learning that are coming out of this, and we've seen a lot of that today. But equally, I think you can talk quite cynically about the desire to skill up and actually the attack against certain sort of types of learning for the need for people to present certain skills. That's certainly true at the foundation degree level, and I think that's somehow slightly true at some of the kind of CDA level, and that sometimes can create, as a very, very new academic on the other side of the fence, a two-tier world within universities of those people who do real research and those of us who work on these weird collaborations. And that's great for getting ticking government boxes, and that's great for setting up new courses and getting FTEs, et cetera, et cetera. But we won't be allowed to join the proper departments, particularly without the right monographs. So that was really,
wait,
that's really awful.
The ref changes it. The ref is going to change everything, I think.
So you think that will change a lot of that?
I think it will. Because I think when the ref starts looking at impact, it's going to incentivize a different kind of behavior. That's
cool.
What it's done before.
Now, I'm just looking down to the organizers here to make sure they're happy for us to wrap up. And yeah, okay. Well, let's call it a day. It just remains for me to thank our panelists for coming and giving their time and sharing their thoughts in this very open way, and clearly succeeded in triggering a good deal of response. We've got the opportunity to continue the conversation over a glass of something in the adjoining foyer. Thank you very much for coming for Tate. And just before you leave, I wonder whether I can persuade some of you to come on another occasion, because there's an event going on in the gallery at the moment up in an area called the Devine Studio, which is on the ground floor of the gallery area, right through to the back. What's going on there is a very fascinating display in the form of a series of conversations. It's in the context of a research program which is funded by HRC, and this is all in the hands of my colleague Victoria Walsh, who's standing at the back, and we'll be happy to take questions on this. The project's called Research in Process, and I think that the work going on there touches on many of the themes which we've had in the room. It's a four-week conversation which is going on in the effect, and they're getting now towards the end of the first week. But there are some very fascinating discussions which are going to be taking place in the succeeding weeks. For example, next week we've got art museums in digital culture. Well, that's certainly an interdisciplinary topic. And the following week, the conversation, which is going to be chaired, in that case, by Dr. David DeBoza from the University of the Arts, is about visual culture, transmigration, and spectatorship. And the event wraps up with a session which is chaired by Vicky Walsh and Mike Phillips on art and politics, unseen practices. So do have a look at the Tate website if that's at all your kettle of fish. And thanks very much for coming indeed, and I hope that you'll join us for a drink. And join with me to thank our speakers.